እዚ ትሰምዕዎ ዘለኹም መደብ ብቋንቋ ትግርኛ ዝፍኖ ሬድዮ ኤስቢኤስ እዩ።
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me.
Now, you're one of the African experts, having served in Africa for major European, international, not European, international publishing and news organizations. You've written so many books on Africa, on Zaire, the former Zaire, the current Democratic Republic of Congo, Rwanda, Kenya, and Eritrea. Tell us about your book, your writings on Eritrea.
Well, my book on Eritrea is called I Didn't Do It For You. And it was it came out in 2005, so it's not it hasn't just come out. But it was inspired really by me visiting Asmara several times and just being so amazed by what I found there. This was in 96 when a lot of people were coming back from the diaspora. Obviously the EPLF had had seized power, and Eritrea had found become an independent country, and it was a time of great hope, and the diaspora was going back, they were investing, they were opening shops, there was rebuilding, reconstruction taking place everywhere, and I was so affected by this sort of atmosphere of optimism and hope. And then I began to meet all these fighters, ex-fighters, who were telling me what they had done during the recent struggle. And I got really fascinated by the history of Eritrea, which seemed to me a country which had been repeatedly interfered with by the West in particular, including Italy, Britain, Russia, America, for various reasons. Everyone had their own reasons for interfering in Eritrea. And then bringing it up to the sort of modern day, which, by the time I was finishing the book, was when you had the roundup of the G15 by Isaias Afwerki arresting his nearest colleagues. And of course, most of them, tragically, have not been seen since. And so it was sort of, it really covered 100 years of history. And after it came out, I knew I would never go back. I went back once when it had just been published, and there was still an atmosphere in 2005 where you could still just about criticise Isaias Afwerki and it would be allowed. But in the years that followed, it became quite clear that that would no longer be permitted. And you just saw this more and more, the sort of strongman rule and the press, the free press closing down, the university closing, obligatory national service becoming more and more oppressive and open-ended. And then this extraordinary flood of people out of the country. And that had barely begun when I was publishing that book. But I think, since then, we've just seen this sort of loss, this hemorrhaging of young people, which has been a terrible loss for Eritrea. But I completely understand why they've done it. And of course, a lot of them have ended up in Australia and also, elsewhere, New Zealand, in the UK, Sweden, Europe. And now we're seeing this new generation coming up, which is sort of saying, we have to start organizing, we have to fight back. And that's what we're seeing now. It's a very, very interesting moment in Eritrean history.
Yeah, it's a fascinating country because, as far as I know, it's one of the countries that has gone through one of the longest liberation wars in Africa, not against a European country, but against their neighbor. The colonization was
Mengistu. Well, first Haile Selassie.
Haile Selassie, and then Mengistu.
And then Mengistu Haile Mariam. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And against all odds. I mean, one of the famous books written about that period and about Eritrea was called Against All Odds, because nobody thought that they would succeed. But they did. And I think, the tragedy is that this has gone, the victory and the liberation experience has been so disappointing and so bitter. And that's, why I think a lot of young people fleeing the country who don't want to do national service, often when they get to Europe or the West, they don't want to get involved in campaigning against, against their own government. But I think that is changing now. And you see the Blue Brigade, which is this movement that is gathering force and that has been sort of cropping up all around the world, in Canada, in Germany, in Switzerland, in the UK, in Israel, and here in Melbourne. You know, the Blue Brigade has been very active, and it's young people who are sort of saying, this is our country and we have to fight for change in it. We can't just we can't leave and turn our backs to what we left behind.
And it's a country that's I'm just putting myself in the, you know, just make myself like a devil's advocate. They have one of the toughest military service. I think one of the longest in Africa, if not in the world, I think.
That is really why people are leaving, because you never know when it finishes. As you say, it has been, this is a tough army. They train in Sawa, in this very sort of desert sort of location. And I think what we saw in the recent war in Tigray, in northern Ethiopia, was that this was an army that, you know, as a rebel movement, the Eritrean, the EPLF, was famous for its compassion and its respect for human rights amongst prisoners, for example, or the way it treated areas in which it was active. And what we saw in Tigray was really brutal, terribly brutal treatment, mass rape, burning of crops, so that, you know, creation of starvation conditions, looting of businesses, destruction of clinics so that nobody could get medical treatment. And I think that was really shocking to people who knew the old EPLF. And they sort of thought, oh, wow, you know, this new army that has come out of this obligatory national service is capable of atrocities. And that was a very, very sad and tragic thing to witness.
But it's a country that's wedged between some tough neighbors, the Tigray area and Ethiopia itself, which is believed to be always eyeing on the port of Assab, because Ethiopia being landlocked and it's a quickly developing economy, they have no other outlet. They've got no sea except Djibouti, maybe. And now they've signed, I think, an agreement with Somaliland to use their port. So Assab is the closest, and they've got direct infrastructure going into their country. So Eritrea would be justified to have such a harsh militaristic kind of approach, because otherwise they'll be taken over.
Well, you know, it's a complicated situation. Assab was famously really an Ethiopian-controlled port. The business interests were so considerable there, and all the sort of people who worked there were Ethiopian. So it was a de facto Ethiopian port. And you have certainly been seeing the Ethiopian Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, talking about access to the sea in a way that I find chillingly reminiscent of Haile Selassie, the emperor, who always used to talk about, we need to have access to the sea. And that was his justification for ending the federal arrangement with Eritrea in the 1950s and just seizing Eritrea and turning it into the northernmost province of Ethiopia. Personally, I think, access to the sea and worrying about it only has relevance if you're not planning to have a good relationship with your neighbours, because, you know, a country that has a decent and a strong relationship and understanding with its neighbour, and its neighbour has a coastline, shouldn't be fretting and worrying about access to the sea.
Yeah, and coming back to the title, why a provocative title like the one you chose?
It was a reference to an incident in 1941 when the British army had been fighting Italian's fascist forces in Eritrea, in Keren. It was an exhausting and much tougher battle than the British army had been expecting. I won't use the precise language that was used, but as supposedly there's this famous story which was told to me by an Eritrean historian, that as one of the British soldiers, they'd won the Battle of Keren and they were marching towards Asmara, having beaten the Italians, and this woman was on her knees ululating, thanking, Eritrean woman, thanking the British army for having beaten the Italian fascists. years. And he said, I didn't do it for you. And added an epithet, which I won't repeat. And I use that quote because it seemed to me it was the theme of my book, which is that so often in Eritrean history, people didn't do it for the Eritreans. They did it for their own reasons. They intervened for their own reasons. That's the history of Eritrea, and it has molded and shaped Eritrea. And of course, now you have a government that is very, very much touts its self-reliance and is saying, you know, we won't let anyone else decide our fate for us. And that really is that's a message that Isaias Afewerki, this famously determined, stubborn, impervious leader, he is always saying, you know, I'll decide our future. So it seemed to me a very relevant theme.
Yeah, and you say government that's autosufficient, that is self-sufficient.
Self-reliant.
Yeah. One would argue it's a positive thing to be self-reliant. But again, on the other side, this self-reliance reeks of something more sinister because the regime is depicted as one of the last hermetic regimes in the world, comparable to North Korea or Cuba or something like that.
I remember when I first visited Asmara, and they have a lot of murals in Asmara that commemorate important moments in the struggle, the liberation struggle. And I remember reading an article written by an American journalist who said, you know, North Korean-style, you know, graffitis and on the walls. And I remember thinking, this is so wrong. This is not North Korea, because I was having a lot of interviews with people. Everyone wanted to talk to journalists. Everyone wanted to give their opinions. Nobody was worried about what they were saying to you. All the government ministers, there was no formality. They were happy to interact with you. They were so confident of what they thought. But that is no longer true. That was 96 and onwards. And now as a journalist, I know I'll never be able to go to Eritrea under this regime. It's almost unheard of for journalists to go into Eritrea. There is no free press. The last time I went there in 2005, I knew that I was being followed around town. I knew that anyone I spoke to would have to report to the government and tell them what they had, you know, what we had discussed. The only conversations I managed to have with people were in their cars, you know, sitting on the outskirts of town. That was the only place that they felt safe talking to me. They didn't want to talk in cafes or restaurants. The atmosphere had completely changed. It had become a very monitored, very paranoid, very frightened place to be. And it was really sad to see that. So by the time of my last visit, the comparison to North Korea was very accurate. And so I went from thinking this is a completely inappropriate label to thinking this is now actually a very accurate description. And it's only got worse since I had that trip.
Wow. My next question was going to be, any glimmer of hope after such a really, I'd say, frightening picture of this place?
Well, the glimmer of hope are Eritreans, of course, aren't they? And young people, hardworking, energetic, hopeful, determined, and the country, you know, is producing these amazing youngsters. And what you have to hope for is that there will be one day a change in that country, which means that they won't be leaving in the way they are, because it's such a massive loss for this country that they're losing all that talent and all that ambition and all those hopes.
And now, anything you'd like to add to the conversation we may have missed that's really important to bring to the attention of our listeners?
No, I mean, the one other thing is I noticed that the Eritrean community is very divided in a lot of the countries. So what you see is that young Eritreans who leave because they don't want to do national service, some of them will then get co-opted by the government. And then you have mutual recrimination, clashes. Things have turned violent in quite a lot of countries. It's really got quite worrying. And there is this irony that people who fled the country because they didn't want to be conscripted are later then being recruited by the embassy or the honorary consul in the country, and then sort of clash with other young Eritreans who have fled. And when this happened in Israel not that long ago, the Israeli government said to the people who were fighting on the side of the government, you know, if you're so pro-government, why are you here? You know, you asked for political asylum in Israel. Why are you here? If you love your country and you're so happy with the regime, you should be back there. And I think that's a valid point. And sometimes people forget that, you know, if you've applied for political asylum, and then you go, you know, you end up in a kind of big bust up fighting people who are pro-opposition, something a little strange has happened.
Yeah, and it's not only in Israel. I've heard about similar tensions actually going on even here in Australia. So
it's happened in Melbourne. It's happened in Europe. It's happened in lots of cities in Germany. This has been a trend around the world because, of course, Eritreans can be found all over the world.
Michaela Rong, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us on SBS Tigrinya.
It's a pleasure.
SBS
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 SBS Radio.